Okay, good afternoon. This is Bio 160, December 4th, and we're almost done with urinary system. We're going to go over the questions at the end of the chapter, just to make sure you got the same thing that I'm thinking for answers for the review questions. But before we do that, I want to make sure everybody knows what the schedule is. Okay, so we do have a quiz next time, quiz number 14 on urinary system. That's an optional quiz. You don't have to take it. If you've got 12 that you like your grades of already, you don't have to take number 14. But if you get 100% on this one, you can drop a lower score if you want to. Plus, you never know. There might be a question on the quiz that comes up on the test. So it's kind of a good review for you for the test anyway. Right? So everybody might as well take the quiz, though they don't have to. And then the last test, our final exam, 1 to 3 p.m. Thursday, which is next week. Oh, it's a week from today. And that's what time is that?
1 to 3.
Do I have it? Oh, yeah, 1 to 3. 1 to 3. And it's got to be on 15, 17, and 19. So that's what? That is the digestive system, urinary system, and diversification system. Okay? Okay. So, I tell you what, before we move on and answer some more of those questions, let me ask you a couple questions and go over some anatomy real quick, because it's important for you guys to know this. What is the structural and functional unit of life?
Cell.
That's a cell. What's the structural and functional unit of contraction? Yeah, muscle is specialized for contraction. But what is what's that structural and functional unit inside muscle that allows it to contract? A sarcomere. Fantastic. What's the structural and functional unit of communication between cells called?
A synapse,
right? So you should be flashing back to all of those things. Those aren't going to be on your last test, but it's good that you can articulate that. And then something that might be on the test is, what's the structural and functional unit of urine formation? That's the nephron. Right, so that's something you do have to know for the last test. And if you are going to break down a nephron into two major components, what are the two major components? The two major components of a nephron?
Tubular elements.
Tubular elements, and what does a tubular element contain? Those are components of the tubular elements. But what's inside of a tubular element? What is it? It is transporting filtrate. It's processing filtrate, and when it's done being processed, it becomes urine. That's right. So tubular elements contain filtrate at the beginning, and it gets processed into urine. All right, so that's one. What's the other major component? The vascular elements. What's in a vascular element?
Blood.
Exactly right. Okay, now you got to know the names of all those components and how they hook up with each other. And then you got to know three processes too. So those are the elements. What are the three processes?
Filtration
that makes filtrate.
Tubular
reabsorption. And tubular secretion. Those are the three functions of a nephron. And after all those three processes, then you end up with urine. Right. Okay. So who wants to come up to the board and draw a nephron out? You think maybe I should do it one more time? Oh, okay. How about if we start with the tubular elements first? Tubular elements. What's the most proximal component of the tubular elements of the nephron? That's close, but not quite. Not quite a convoluted tubule. Bowman's capsule is the first thing. So I'm going to write abbreviations on the board. I'll say it out loud, but I'm not going to write out the names. All right, so here's Bowman's capsule right here. And the Bowman's capsule collects filtrate, and then filtrate moves into the proximal convoluted tubule, and then that goes to the not quite. So proximal convoluted tubule moves filtrate into the loop of Henle. So in particular, the descending loop, and then the ascending loop, and then that takes filtrate into the distal convoluted tubule right here. And then where does it go? To the collecting duct. right? And that leaves the tip of a renal pyramid into the renal pelvis and then down through a ureter into the urinary bladder. So this right here is Bowman's capsule. Here is the proximal convoluted tubule. Here is the descending loop of Henle. Here is ascending loop of Henle, distal convoluted tubule, and collecting duct. All right, those are all the tubular elements. Right? All right, vascular elements. There aren't many of them, but how does blood get into the nephron? Afferent, arterial. And then inside Bowman's capsule, there is a network of, what are these little things? That's the glomerulus. That's the glomerulus, but really what is the glomerulus? It's a capillary. What's a capillary specialized for? Exchange, and in particular, a special kind of capillary. They're very leaky. Okay, they're fenestrated capillaries, so a lot of plasma leaks out into Bowman's capsule. And the remainder flows into this little tube right here. Oh, I didn't label this. This right here is glomerulus, right? Glomerulus inside Bowman's capsule. And then this tube is the efferent, or the arterial leaving the glomerulus. And then that forms a bunch of capillaries around all of the tubules. So what do we call all of these capillaries here? Peritubular capillaries. Yeah, so the nephron is kind of interesting because you see two capillary beds. The first one is in the glomerulus, and the second one is surrounding all of the tubules, the peritubular capillaries. All right, so those are all the parts of the nephron. And then just let's label on top of these things the three processes that are taking place. This first one right here, one, plasma, not all of the plasma, just very small molecules and water filter out of the glomerulus and move into Bowman's capsule due to pressure. I don't know what's happening here. Hopefully I won't fall through the floor. Okay. So what do we call this first process right here? That's filtration. That's just due to pressure difference between the pressure that's inside the blood and the pressure inside the filtrate in Bowman's capsule. So that's filtration. All things leave, except large molecules and cells. The second, since a lot of fluid is lost by this filtration step, you would dehydrate in just probably a matter of minutes if you weren't to do something to recapture that water that you lost. You don't want it ending up in urine. So here is urine down over here. You don't want to lose all that water in urine. So there is a special process that takes water from a tubular element and puts it back into the, what's in here? What's in this tube? Blood. All right, so this is what we're going to say number two. So tube goes from filtrate to blood. Those are good things that you want in your body. Okay, so what do we call this? This is tubular reabsorption. I'm running out of room. Tubular reabsorption. That's filtrate the blood. And then there still might be bad things in the blood that your body wants to get rid of and put in urine. For instance, there's a breakdown product of proteins that contains a nitrogen group. It's very toxic. It's called urea. And so there are special cells that take urea from the blood and put it into the filtrate. What do we call that process? Tubular secretion. So that gets rid of that harmful waste product of metabolism. So that's three. And I'll just abbreviate it. Tubular secretion. That's tubular secretion. Process number three. Okay, and then after all of this processing happens on filtrate, you end up with urine right there. All right, so maybe you can practice drawing that out and labeling it, but I made a little interactive exercise for you, which might kind of be fun for you to do. I'm not sure. This one right here. So you can go to that website that's in your lecture notes. All right, so you don't have to copy this website down because I copied it right out of your notes. So here is the nephron. Now, this is not the exact picture that you have in your book. This is a much better picture because it's easier to see. It's not so jammed together and tubes on top of tubes that are hard to see. But the one that you have in your book anatomically is exactly equal to this one. It has all the same parts. It's just more difficult to appreciate. All right, so on this exercise, you can find a piece of the nephron, like this thing right here, at the end of this lead line, and you should say in your mind, well, what is this thing right here? That's Bowman's capsule. So if you want to find out if you're true, you can just come over to here and click, and it should say Bowman's capsule. I'm glad. All right, and Bowman's capsule is a proximal part of what kind of element inside the nephron? It's the proximal part of the tubular elements. Tubular elements. What kind of fluid do we have inside Bowman's capsule? That's filtrate. Okay, then filtrate moves into this tubule right here. What's the name of this tubule? Proximal convoluted tubule. And then from the proximal convoluted tubule, it moves into the DLH, descending loop of Henle. All right, and then it moves back up through the ascending loop into the distal convoluted tubule, and finally it ends up in the collecting duct. All right, so you can just trace all these things around. Don't change the names of any of these things on the test, right? Make sure you know the right order. And this blood vessel is called the afferent arteriole. Here is the glomerulus, and then the efferent arteriole, and then the peritubular capillaries over here. All right, so I'm sure y'all can get 100% on the test with that particular diagram. Okay? All right. So any questions on that stuff so far? No? All right, well, let's go to answering some more of the questions. Where did we leave off? Number three? No? Let's see if I even have the questions. I got a feeling I do. So what question number? Oh, we're not very far along at all, are we? Okay, we can do number one. Here's my number one. Know the structures of the urinary system. Okay. Well, what's the first, and we're just talking gross structures. So structures you can see with your eye. You got the kidneys. Kidneys produce urine, which flows into the ureters, which flows into the urinary bladder, and then from the urinary bladder, it leaves the body via the urethra. Right. Those are the four things. And what are the functions of the urinary system? Some of these things are obvious. Some are not so obvious. Yeah, they maintain pH of the body, because when your body becomes very acidic through tubular secretion, your body can secrete hydrogen ions into the filtrate, increasing your pH back to normal. So not only hydrogen ions, but sodium and potassium and things like that. What else? Yeah, red blood cell production. Because there's a part in the kidney that measures oxygen concentration in the blood. And if oxygen concentration decreases, then the kidney is going to secrete a hormone. What's the name of that hormone? Erythropoietin. Erythropoietin is the name of that hormone, which goes to red bone marrow, and it stimulates red bone marrow to produce red blood cells. So that's another function. What else? Yeah, pH and electrolytes. Regulates pH and electrolytes. Plus water balance. Okay. And because it controls water balance in your body, it gets water from your blood. So it helps control blood volume. If it removes a lot of water from your blood volume is going to decrease. And when your kidney adjusts blood volume, that's another way of adjusting blood pressure. So if a kidney takes water out of your blood, what happens to your blood pressure, do you think? It goes down. Exactly right. Yep, it goes down. So just like if you have air in your tire and you take pressure, if you take air out, your pressure goes down in that tire. That's a kind of a good way to think of that. All right, what other functions? Oh, and then the obvious one, I forgot. You're right. It removes waste products from the blood. Like, could you give me an example? Oh, I thought I would write it on the board. I didn't write it on the board, but you should know it. It is urea, right? It is urea. Okay, good example. All right, describe the shape of a kidney. It's bean-shaped, like a kidney bean, okay. It's about as big as your hand. Where are the location of the kidneys?
Posterior abdominal
cavity. Yes, they're the posterior abdominal cavity. On either side of the vertebral column. That's right. They're bilateral. You have two. And what does retroperitoneal mean? That's right. There is a peritoneal membrane that lines the abdominal cavity, and most of your organs in your abdominal cavity are inside that membrane, but the kidneys are different. They're on the outside of that membrane. They're more associated, they're more closely associated with the muscles of your back than the contents of your abdominal cavity. There's that peritoneal membrane between them. So therefore, we call the kidneys retroperitoneal, meaning behind the kidneys. All right, so you got to know the gross anatomy of the kidneys. Well, what's the layer right on the outside of a kidney called? That's called the, right on the outside, it's before you even get into the kidney. It's the renal capsule. That's right, that's connective tissue that surrounds the kidney. And then the outermost layer of the kidney, but not the capsule, that's the cortex. And then the deeper layers of the kidney are what we call the renal medulla. Between what, ribs and vertebrae and things like that? That's a little bit much for me. Okay. Okay. Let's see. Other gross features of the kidney? You know, if you look at a kidney, if you open one up, you can see the pyramids. You can see the renal columns. You can see the calyces, right? And you can see the renal pelvis. So those are all the gross features of the kidneys that you should be able to identify on a slide. And you know what? There might even be one of these interactive exercises here for that. Let's just take a look real quick. It's not too bad. Like, what's this here? That's actually the ureter, I hope. Ah, yes, I was right. Okay, and then what is this funnel-shaped structure that is carrying filtrate into the ureter? That is the renal pelvis. Okay, and then here, where's that pointing to? That looks like a tip of a renal pyramid, a papillae, maybe a minor calyx. Ooh, let's see what we say here. Calyx. And this is the hilus or hilum of the kidney. This is where everything enters and leaves the kidney, this indentation in the kidney. So hilum, the indentation. Here's renal vein, renal artery. Here's a renal, kind of looks like a pyramid to me. All right, renal pyramid. Oh, that's the base of a pyramid. Okay, let's see what I say here. So this, I guess, is a pyramid. Renal pyramid. And then here's a papillae. It's either a papillae or an apex. I don't know what I call it. Tip and base. Okay, don't use those terms very much. Here's a renal capsule. This is a pyramid, I hope? No. Yeah, let's see what it says. Renal pyramid. I hope it doesn't say column, because a column is close. It's right here. Maybe medulla. And here is cortex. All right, so cortex and medulla. Okay. What is the functional structural unit of the kidney? That's a really short answer. Nephron. What are the parts of the nephron? Well, we went over that, right? You could say, well, it's broken down into vascular elements, tubular elements, and these are all them. Name the vessels associated with the nephron. Well, those are just the vascular elements. Those are on the board. Name the three steps or processes which work together to produce urine. We did that already. Filtration, tubular reabsorption, tubular secretion. Where does tubular filtration take place? Yeah, between the glomerulus and Bowman's capsule right here. That's where filtration. Filtration doesn't take place anywhere else in the nephron, only that very first part of it. That's a good question. Where does filtration take place? True. Where does reabsorption take place? Between a tubular element, like a convoluted tubule, and a peritubular capillary. So reabsorption is always going to involve a peritubular capillary. It's never going to involve the glomerulus. Because what function is involved with a glomerulus? That's always going to be filtration. Yeah, that's filtration. All of the tubular elements except Bowman's capsule for reabsorption and the same for secretion. All of the tubular elements and only the peritubular capillary for secretion and reabsorption. How much initial filtrate becomes urine? Oh, I don't know if I said this in lecture. Maybe I did. Yeah, you're right. So of all the blood volume that's coming into the glomerulus, 20% gets lost in Bowman's capsule, gets filtered out, but you can't afford to lose 20% of your blood volume. So in the way that urine is processed, 99% of it is resorbed by the peritubular capillary, so that means only 1% ends up in the urine. So that's how active that nephron is. So 1% comes out. Name three hormones that regulate kidney function by acting as antidiuretics or as diuretics. Okay, so let's do antidiuretics first. What's the name of a hormone that's an antidiuretic? Yes, as a matter of fact, you're right. Antidiuretic hormone. And what does that make you do? Lose fluid or retain fluid? That makes you retain fluids when you're dehydrated or you eat too much salt or something. Okay, ADH. What's another one that acts as an antidiuretic besides ADH? Aldosterone acts as an antidiuretic hormone. All right, so here, those are two hormones, ADH and aldosterone. If they make you retain fluids, what do you think the effect is on your blood pressure when you retain fluids? It goes up or it's maintained. Maintained or elevates, right? And what kind of hormone acts as a diuretic? Atrial natriuretic hormone. Is it atrial natriuretic hormone? Because it stimulates the secretion of sodium, which promotes water loss in your body. So that acts as what, an antidiuretic or a diuretic if it promotes water loss? It acts as water loss. It acts as a diuretic. Okay. So which ones of those three hormones are synergistic? ADH and aldosterone. Which ones are antagonistic to each other? Natriuretic hormone. Yeah, ADH and atrial natriuretic hormone are antagonistic to each other, as well as aldosterone and atrial natriuretic hormone. Okay. Where does atrial natriuretic hormone come from? The heart. The atrium in particular, when it stretches, when you have too much blood volume, your heart stretches too much, and that causes you to pee and lose blood volume. Okay. Know the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism. Okay.
What?
Know the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism. Did I go over that?
No.
Oh, good. Something else to talk about today then. Okay. Let's skip down to number 8, and then maybe I'll go back up to 7. Where does antidiuretic hormone come from? It's from the pituitary gland. And the pituitary gland is very close to your brain. So there's a place in your brain, namely the hypothalamus, that is always monitoring water concentration in your blood. And when your blood gets too salty, then it stimulates the pituitary to release antidiuretic hormone, which makes you retain water, which then dilutes your blood out again. And where does atrial natriuretic hormone come from? Oh, we said that already. Okay, that comes from the heart. All right, what about the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism? I got it right here. Okay. Here it is right here. I got to turn the computer off, though. Here it is. Unless I drop the projector. Okay, so this is the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism. Sometimes we call this the dreaded renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism. Okay, because people don't like it for some reason. But it's very important because this is the most important mechanism for controlling blood pressure in your body. Not from second to second or minute to minute, for instance, when you change body position, but in your everyday life. This is why people have hypertension, for instance. Is hypertension an important disease to become aware of? Yeah, because it kills thousands of people all the time. It's very prevalent. All right, so let's take a look and see how that works. Okay, so there's an organ in your body that is making a chemical compound all the time and putting it in your blood, and that's the liver. And the liver is making angiotensinogen. All right, so when you look at that word, angiotensinogen, do you have any feel for what that chemical compound is doing? Can it do anything or can it not do anything? It is inactive. Yeah, it's a precursor molecule. Because that ogen on the end of it says that it's a precursor. It's inactive, but your body is making it all the time so that it can be converted into an active form very quickly, should the circumstances arise. Okay, so that's the job of the liver, to make angiotensinogen, and puts it in the blood. Okay, then you have a kidney over here, and the kidney can monitor blood pressure. There are cells that can monitor blood pressure in the kidney, and can actually measure blood volume, the saltiness of blood. And when blood pressure decreases, or when the water content of blood decreases, the blood gets more salty, the kidney releases an enzyme. So the initial stimulus is going to be a decrease in blood pressure or a decrease in water in the blood. The kidney is going to release an enzyme called renin, just R-E-N-I-N. So that's in the blood, and it's an enzyme. It's going to convert angiotensinogen, which is inactive, into angiotensin 1. And angiotensin 1 has some activity, but it's not terribly active. It needs to be converted into something else, which we call angiotensin 2. And where it gets converted, into angiotensin 2 is in the liver, because blood goes, in the lungs. Because blood goes to the lungs all the time, and there's an enzyme in the lungs that converts angiotensin 1 into angiotensin 2. And the name of that enzyme is called angiotensin converting enzyme. Angiotensin converting enzyme. It converts 1 into 2. Okay. And angiotensin 2 has a couple of effects. It can cause vasoconstriction. And when blood vessels constrict, what do you think happens to blood pressure? So think of a balloon, and you squeeze down on a balloon, what happens to pressure inside that balloon? It goes up. If you squeeze too hard on a balloon, what's going to happen? It's going to pop, right, because the pressure is too high. All right, so vasoconstriction causes an increase in blood pressure. What was the initial stimulus? Was a decrease in blood pressure. I don't know, could you see my finger when I moved it? Yeah, you could. Interesting. Okay, decrease in blood pressure. I didn't know if I was just doing that. That I don't know if you can see. That you can see. All right, so a decrease in blood pressure, but this vasoconstriction produces what? The opposite effect. So what do we call it when the stimulus, okay, and the response subtract from each other? What kind of feedback loop is that? That's called a negative feedback loop. So this response subtracts from the stimulus that brings you back into homeostasis or normal blood pressure. If the response were to add to the stimulus, then your blood pressure would get lower and lower and lower, and that would be the end of you, right? So your blood pressure comes back. All right, angiotensin 2 also increases aldosterone secretion. And aldosterone comes from a organ that's on top of the kidneys right here, which we call the adrenal gland. And aldosterone increases the reabsorption of water from the kidney filtrate. So it takes water from the filtrate, puts it back in the blood. Your blood volume increases as a result. What happens to blood pressure when your blood volume increases? Blood pressure increases. Just like if you were to blow air into a balloon, what would happen to the pressure in that balloon? It would go up. It certainly wouldn't go down, right? Okay. So everything in this mechanism right here increases blood pressure. Okay. Plus, angiotensin 2 also increases your sensation of thirst, right? So you're going to drink fluids. That's going to end up in your blood. That increases blood pressure, too. So this is a renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism. It starts, basically, when the kidney monitors decreased blood pressure. Kidney releases renin. Renin converts angiotensinogen into angiotensin 1. Then the lung converts angiotensin 1 into 2. And then angiotensin 2 increases blood pressure by vasoconstriction and by stimulating the release of aldosterone. Aldosterone, remember, is aldosterone a diuretic or an antidiuretic? Antidiuretic. So when you take an antidiuretic, your blood pressure goes up. When you take a diuretic, your blood pressure goes down. And we use diuretics to treat hypertension all the time. So you see, the control of blood volume in terms of regulating blood pressure is very important. So that's one way we can treat hypertension, is by giving somebody a diuretic. There are other ways that we can help somebody with hypertension too. Right, notice I said that the renin angiotensin aldosterone mechanism is the most important for regulating blood pressure in people. So how can we manipulate this system to lower somebody's blood pressure? Because what is the effect of renin or angiotensin or aldosterone? Is to increase blood pressure. So if we were to interrupt this mechanism somehow, their blood pressure would have a tendency to come down. All right, so one of the good kinds of drugs that we can use besides diuretics to lower somebody's blood pressure is to stop this conversion of angiotensin 1 into angiotensin 2. And this enzyme, the long form of that enzyme is called angiotensin converting enzyme, but nobody says that. They just say ACE, A-C-E. So the name of that enzyme is ACE. And if we inhibit ACE, right, then you won't be able to make angiotensin 2, and that's not going to have the same properties for maintaining or raising your blood pressure. So that's another class of drugs that's frequently prescribed for hypertension, and these are what we call ACE inhibitors. So can you see, where does an ACE inhibitor work? In the step between angiotensin 1 and angiotensin 2. Okay. The adrenal cortex. The adrenal cortex and the adrenal gland is right on top of the kidney, right about there. Okay. That's where aldosterone comes from. And there are going to be other classes of drugs that are going to be used frequently. For instance, there might be aldosterone receptor blockers. These are kind of new drugs. And when somebody has hypertension, it's actually kind of hard to treat. And most people have to take more than just one drug. They might have to take a diuretic and an ACE inhibitor. Or maybe a diuretic and an ACE inhibitor and something that's going to cause vasodilation of blood vessels, which counteracts the effect of this vasoconstriction. When you vasodilate a blood vessel, your blood pressure is going to go down. All right, so if you have any family members that have hypertension, then you have to be really supportive of them, because hypertension is a really deadly disease. It certainly will eventually kill you, produce heart attacks and strokes and a lot of vascular disease. But kind of the sad thing about having hypertension is that when your blood pressure is elevated, when your blood pressure is high, that's when you feel good. That's when you feel great. And when your blood pressure is normal, that's when you feel really lethargic and feel bad. So there's not a lot of reinforcement for somebody to control their blood pressure. But if they don't, what's going to happen to them? They're going to die, right? So it's really important they control that. So what is a normal blood pressure? You should probably know that because it's so important. So 120 over 80, so that's systolic pressure over diastolic pressure. And as your blood pressure gets higher than that, then you just are more susceptible to cardiovascular damage. As your blood pressure gets less than that, you're more and more protected from cardiovascular damage. Why is that? I'm not sure we really understand why. Okay? Yeah, and so we don't have any really good antidotes for that. So somebody usually has to adjust. So after a period of maybe about a year or 2 years that they're on the correct blood pressure medication, they start to feel okay again. Okay? So they have to be on it for a while before they automatically adjust to it. Okay? Which is kind of a shame. Okay? Maybe someday we'll figure out why they feel more lethargic and prevent that situation from happening altogether. So what about if your blood pressure is 100 over 60? What do we call that? That is hypotension. And is that good or bad? Okay. You know what? That's below normal, but that's excellent. That's really good, because as your blood pressure gets lower and lower, then your cardiovascular system is even more protected from damage. Okay, so that's why 120 over 80 is just kind of a ballpark number, but it shouldn't really be much greater than that. Now, your blood pressure can be so low that maybe when you stand up, you pass out. That's what we call hypotension as well. Now, is that good? No, because then you're going to hit your head on the table, right, and then the chair, and then the floor when you pass out. So that's nasty. So if your blood pressure is low, that's great as long as you don't get dizzy or woozy when you stand up or change body position or pass out when you're driving a car or something. Then, of course, if that happens to you, then you need treatment. You need something to boost your blood pressure back up or find out why it is so low. All right? But generally, hypotension is a nice protective thing, and you're just kind of lucky that you have low blood pressure because you're probably protected from cardiovascular disease from that standpoint. Okay? All right, so that's it for the urinary system. So we ended it with a big discussion on blood pressure. So you can see that the function of the urinary system, one of the major functions is to help control your, not just urine formation, but blood pressure. Yeah, it's really important for controlling blood pressure through this mechanism right here, the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism. I don't know if that's an exam figure. I don't think it is. Next semester, maybe. Okay. All right, so that takes us to the, what did I call it in your syllabus? Oh, okay. I called it the reproductive system. So, let's see. That's sort of a nice introduction to the reproductive system right there. All right, well, before we start talking about the anatomy of the reproductive system, let's talk about the function of the reproductive system. And I'll give anybody 5 extra credit points if you know what the function of the reproductive system is. To reproduce. Wrong. Close. Close, that's only close. Okay, but you read that off there. Okay, doesn't matter. You're right. Okay, so you get the extra credit point. So in my impression, all right, the function of the reproductive system is to produce new and unique individuals. Well, what does that really mean? There are a lot of organisms, when they produce young, all of a sudden, a young organism is going to start growing from the side of their body. For instance, are you familiar with what a hydra is? A hydra is what we call a cnidarian. It lives in the ocean, and it has tentacles, and it eats shrimp, and anemones are sort of like that, too. It can eat fish if it catches them. It's got stinging cells, and it puts it in its mouth. You know, they're tiny. It's not anything you could get eaten with, but anyway, when they reproduce, they just grow another little organism on their side, and when that little organism gets big enough, it breaks away, and then there's another one right next to the parent organism, right? And that organism that just grew right there is exactly the same as the one that it budded off from. So I suppose that's good that we don't, like, all of a sudden just start growing babies off our sides, right, and drop off. That doesn't happen with humans. Okay, because we reproduce with sexual reproduction. But so it works for some organisms to produce asexually, but when you reproduce asexually, what does the new generation look like? Exactly like the parent generation, right? So asexual reproduction produces the same organism over and over and over and over again. Okay? But that's not so with how humans reproduce. Okay, and at some point in time, you might have asked, well, why do we have all this complexity in the human population? Why is there such a thing as a uterus and vagina and penis and testes and all this apparatus? What is it good for? Right? What does it provide the human population, all that complexity? And if you look around the room, the answer is pretty much plain as the nose on your face. So if you look around the room, do you see another you anywhere? You see another you. No? If you went to a football game like at the Coliseum and there's 100,000 people in the Coliseum and you looked at every single one, are you going to find another you there? And if you look over the whole world, are you ever going to find another you? Well, you might have a twin, right, if you're born at exactly the same time, okay? But there is not another you. So the purpose of the reproductive system is to produce something that's new and unique, all right? And we need a couple sexes in order for that to happen. So new individuals are not just from one parent, they're a combination of traits from two parents, right, which produces something new and unique when that happens. All right, so as a matter of fact, your parents produced you at one time. Okay, they produced you at one time, and if you're a woman, see, you're different, right? You're different than your. That was my next question. If you're a woman in here, are you exactly like your mom? No, you're going to say no, but some of you might be close, but not exactly, right? And if you're a guy, are you exactly like your dad? Some of you might be close, but not exact copies, right? Because you definitely are new and unique. Now, so your parents came together and formed you. Could they ever make another you later on in their life, like 10 years later? Could they ever make another you? And you know what? As a matter of fact, they could. They could make another you. It's theoretically possible. But the chances, the odds of that happening are so astronomically high that it has never happened and will probably never, ever happen. As a matter of fact, if there is sexual reproduction like there is on Earth, anywhere in the universe, nowhere in the universe have two parents that have sexually reproduced ever produced an identical twin later on in their life. It is certainly possible, but the process of sexual reproduction is so powerful in producing what we call diversity that it just can't really happen, just only because of odds. Okay, it would be like having a coin that has, oh, millions and millions and millions of sides on it. So if you were to flip that coin, the chances of that coin ever coming up with the same side is just impossible. It is possible, but the probability would be really, really slim for that to happen. Okay. Okay, so do you think because of that, let me ask you another question. So that's the function of the reproductive system, produce new and unique individuals to produce diversity in the population. Is it, are two sexes, two genders enough? Or should there be three genders or four sexes? Are two sexes enough? I know this is very confusing, but we're going to see why in a second. It's really good. Are two sexes enough? You would say? Yes, you said yes. Why do you say yeah? Well, it's hard enough to deal with just two genders, I suppose. Okay, that's rational. Okay, that's a rational thought. But again, if you look around the whole world, are you going to find another you anywhere? You're not going to find another you, so two genders are perfect. That's enough to ensure that every individual is new and unique. Okay, so having male and female is fine. We don't need a third gender or a fourth or any other kind of gender for that to happen. Well, you know, sex is really complicated. Yeah, the gender of a person is really complicated. It depends on what kind of chromosomes you end up with, and you're not guaranteed to get the correct number of chromosomes. It depends on how your brain works, for instance. The male brain typically, in terms of hormones, is very constant, but the female brain is very cyclic in nature. Okay, so it pays attention to more kinds of rhythms and things like that. So if you're a person that has male chromosomes but your brain is more cyclic, that's kind of a conflict to what we think of a general, you know, gender, male or female. And what else? And there's genitalia. What happens if you have a brain that is kind of constant and you have maybe male chromosomes but you have female genitalia? Well, then that's a little abnormal too. So sex is a really kind of complicated thing. And then, of course, there's choice, which I don't think anybody understands yet. Why some people feel like they're female, or why some people feel like they're a male. I don't think we have any idea why that is. Whether they're anatomically male or female, they have feelings one way or the other, right? So, yeah, gender is a very complicated thing. But I suppose I can understand why all that happens, and that is because the underlying feature of sexuality is to make sure that everybody is new and unique. Right, and so if somebody's in between, that's what? That's still new and unique, right? Yeah. Okay, so that's the purpose of sexual reproduction. All right, and I also usually talk about, I don't have it with me here, but I'll just write it on the board real quick. The state of Texas, I think in the 70s, started a program called Baby Safe. They started some baby safe laws, and what that just says, and pretty much all the states in the United States adopted this policy, and that is if somebody is pregnant and they have a baby and they don't want that baby, within 24 or 48 hours they can surrender that baby to a fire station or a hospital emergency room, and they won't have any obligations, financial obligations or any kind of obligations to raise that baby. So they just give it up for adoption without any recourse to them at all. And I don't think anybody in here would be faced with that situation, but I think it's probably pretty important because a lot of times when you have a baby, it's very disruptive to a person's life, right? They're everything that's not just the mother, but the father and the family situation and everything. And sometimes people get really confused. They have a baby and they say, well, there's no way I can care for this baby, and the baby ends up getting killed, right? Like they put it in a dumpster or something. And that's really a sad situation when that happens. So I would promote that understanding of baby or safe haven laws to where, you know, if you ever have a friend that's really conflicted, you know, give the baby up to adoption if they go to term, right? And all they have to do is surrender it in an emergency room or hospital. And L.A. County and Orange County have big programs, but it's babysafela.com if you want more information about that, okay, for surrendering babies. But it's got to be a newborn. Okay. All right, so let's talk about the reproductive system. So what's that function of the reproductive system again? New and unique. Yeah, something new and unique. So that's why we have all these contraptions here. All right, so let me see. Yeah, let's look at this first. So do you have new and unique in your notes or not? You do, good, okay. So the male reproductive system, the primary reproductive structure are the testes. All right, and the testes are these guys down over here. All right, they produce sperm, and they also secrete hormones, sex hormones. These things we call gonads. So a testis is a male primary sexual organ. A gonad is just a general one. So females have gonads, males have gonads. A gonad in a male is a testis. Here's one, testes is plural. And what do females have? What's a primary reproductive organ in a female? Ovaries, right? Okay, so they perform sort of the same kind of function. So testes produce sperm. That kind of cell is what we call a gamete. And hormones, testosterone. Females produce gametes as well, but we don't call them sperm. What do we call them in the female? An egg or oocyte. Okay, and these cells are kind of special. Sperm cells or gametes, oocytes and gametes are kind of special because they only have half the number of chromosomes that are normally found in the human body. And I'll draw something on the board. It will probably make sense why that is. Okay, so an egg or sperm is what we call a gamete. All right, but let's talk about the secondary reproductive structures in the male. We've got the scrotum, and epididymis, the vas deferens, seminal vesicles, urethra, prostate bulbo, urethral gland, and penis. So let's look and see where all these things are. Okay, so here is the male reproductive system. Here is the primary reproductive organ, the testis, and notice that it is not inside the pelvic cavity. It is outside the pelvic cavity in a little pouch we call the scrotum. And it is in this location right here because spermatogenesis has to happen at a lower than normal body temperature. Otherwise, it doesn't work properly. So the testis has to descend from the pelvic cavity into the scrotum, and spermatogenesis can take place properly over here. The other thing is, too, sometimes the testes or gonad is not going to descend into the scrotum. It's going to be retained in the pelvic cavity. In some individuals, that is abnormal and highly dangerous because when a testis is retained in the pelvic cavity, it turns cancerous. right? So if that's the case, then it has to be removed. And another kind of name for a gonad is an orchid, right? And so when a testis fails to descend into the scrotum, we call that crypt orchidism, crypt meaning hidden. All right, so when a newborn male is born, then the scrotum is always palpated, right, to make sure that there are two testes within the scrotum. And if you raise animals at home, like cats and dogs and things like that, you should always check, right, your cats, newborn cats and dogs, make sure that there are two testes in the scrotum down over here, right? Because if not, what's going to happen? Well, you're going to lose that animal prematurely due to cancer because that testes is going to become cancerous. Okay. And if it doesn't descend, then it's got to be removed and the animal will be fine. And if the other testis is there, then of course it still has reproductive potential. If not, right, if both testes are in the pelvic cavity, well, then you'll just neuter that animal early on. Okay, so that's the testes. The other job of the testes, besides producing testosterone, is sperm. And sperm is then released from the testis and it's stored in some very small tubes that are on the top of the testes over here. We call that the epididymis. And they mature in the epididymis, and then during ejaculation, the sperm move out of the epididymis into this tube that carries it back into the pelvic cavity. This is what we call the vas deferens. Sometimes it's called the ductus deferens. All right, and it comes back up into the pelvic cavity, and it's going to pass by a number of glands inside the pelvic cavity. The first one is the seminal vesicle right here. And as the vas deferens passes in past the seminal vesicles, we change the name of it. We call it the ejaculatory duct. And then the ejaculate contains sperm plus secretions from the seminal vesicle. The ejaculate then passes through the prostate gland right here. So here's the prostate gland, and it joins with this tube that goes from the urinary bladder to the urogenital orifice right here at the tip of the penis. So what do we call this tube going from the urinary bladder to the outside world? That is the urethra, right? So the ejaculatory duct then joins with the urethra, and that carries sperm outside to the outside world. So notice that in the male, the reproductive tract, which is this ejaculatory duct, and the urinary tract form one structure. Now that never happens in the human female, but for sure it does in the male. And as ejaculate passes, all right, into the penis, there is another gland that adds volume to the semen, and that's from the bulbourethral gland right here. And I'll talk about the secretions in just a little bit, but let's just focus on anatomy at the moment. Okay, so this part of the urethra going through the prostate gland, we call that the prostatic urethra. The part inside the penis is what we call the penile urethra. Okay, and inside the penis we have some erectile tissue. So here we have, I think this is blue right here. This is the corpus cavernosum, and here is the corpus spongiosum. So sometimes we call this the spongy urethra as well. So this is very spongy kind of tissue, does not contain bones or cartilage or anything like that. This blue right here sort of makes me think that there's cartilage or something in there, but it's not. It's very similar kind of tissue compared to the corpus spongiosum right here. And the way that an erection is maintained is that these sinuses right here fill with blood, right? And it becomes hard and maintains an erection, okay? And so fluids, if it's in a confined space, can actually produce a lot of pressure and become quite hard. As a matter of fact, there was a guy who wanted to make an airplane and carry it around in the trunk of his car. So guess what he used for wings? He would take this plastic model of an airplane that was actually a plastic bag, put it on the ground, and then he had an air pump, and he put air into the wings, and the wings inflated, and there's just so much pressure in the wings that he could fly around on something that had just air pressure in the wings. It wasn't a solid structure. It could fly around and it would land again, and he could deflate the wings and fold it up and put the plane back in his trunk. And I mean, it was a small plane, but still he could fly around. All right, so just by pressure of fluids in these compartments right here certainly can maintain a solid structure. Okay, so that's the male reproductive tract. So how does sperm move again? All right, there are, it goes from epididymis to the vas deferens, to the ejaculatory duct, then through the urethra to the outside world. Okay, this part of the corpus spongiosum we call the glans penis, and then the foreskin is what we call the prepuce right here. The prostate. It adds to the ejaculate. It provides for motility agents as well as nutrients. But I tell you what, we're going to go over that. Okay, we'll go over that. All right, so that's the major male. Okay, number two. All right, so let's look at the... let's look at this right here. Let's talk about the testes a little bit now. In particular, let's focus in on the testes. So they could be up to 5 centimeters in length. On the outside, there's a capsule, just like the kidney has a capsule. There's a capsule around the testes. There are lobes inside the testes because the capsule invaginates or dives deep into the capsule, forming these lobes. And inside the lobes, there are little tubes called seminiferous tubules. And these are pretty much microscopic. You can't see these without a microscope. Inside the tubes, there are a couple different kinds of cells. There are germ cells that produce sperm or spermatogonia. Right? Spermatogonia then turn into spermatocytes. Those are the things that you're kind of familiar with looking at. And remember, a spermatocyte has a special cellular feature that allows it to swim around. What is that little cellular feature that allows it? The flagellum, right? So the flagellum confers motility to a sperm cell, all right? In the seminiferous tubule, there's also something called a Sertoli cell. Now, the sperm, when they're growing inside the seminiferous tubule, require a lot of nutrients. And the Sertoli cell supports that process by giving nutrients to the sperm as they're undergoing the process of becoming spermatocytes. Outside the tubules, there are other cells. And we call these interstitial cells, or cells of Leydig. So interstitial means outside the tubules, and they secrete testosterone. And testosterone is necessary for the germ cells to perform their function, as well as these Sertoli cells. And testosterone is also important to maintain all of the other secondary sex organs in the male. Like, for instance, what's a secondary sex organ in the male? Okay, that would be a male sex characteristic, like deep voice, large musculature, heavy bones, right? Things of that nature. But also, what? Like the seminal vesicles, prostate gland, penis, scrotum, right? These are all things that are dependent on testosterone. All right, so the seminiferous tubules produce sperm, which end up in efferent ductules, and then the efferent ductules lead to the epididymis. So let me see if I've got a picture of some of this stuff. Yeah, not bad. Here it is right here. So here we see a cross-section of the testes right here. Here is the capsule on the outside, and then the capsule invaginates into the testes itself. So these are septations within the testes that give the testes different lobules, and inside the lobules are tubules. All right, so I see like 2 tubules in this lobe right here. Well, there are many, many more than that because these are microscopic. And inside the seminiferous tubules, so if we were to cut one and look inside of it, this is what we would see. So there is an opening on the inside of the tube, which we call the lumen, and this has immature spermatocytes because they develop from cells that are deeper inside the seminiferous tubule. They come from these germ cells, or germinal cells. And there are other cells in here. I can only see one kind of color of cells. It would be nice if they had some other color or different shape. Because besides germ cells, there are also Sertoli cells in there that nourish these germ cells and developing sperm so that spermatogenesis can take place. All right, so then sperm are going to migrate from the seminiferous tubule into the reedy testes, which are these little ducts right here, and then into the epididymis, where they stay until ejaculation takes place. Okay, so, oh, and then the last kind of cell, right? So here is a seminiferous tubule over here. Here's one here. Here's another one. So this space right here is outside the seminiferous tubule. And this is where the interstitial cells are, or the cells of Leydig that produce testosterone, that support all of the secondary male sex organs, as well as spermatogenesis, the cells for spermatogenesis. So if we look at a micrograph, here we can see a seminiferous tubule with different stages of spermatocytes being produced. Here are some that are more mature inside the lumen. And then here are the interstitial cells, or cells of Leydig, that are producing testosterone. Okay. All right, let me go back to, let's see what's next. Okay, so that's all the ducts of the male reproductive system. So you should be able to trace in your mind where sperm is produced and how it has to travel through which ducts to get to the outside world. Okay, so let's talk about some glands. The seminal vesicle, where is that at? Okay, that's inside the pelvic cavity. So look at that vas deferens coming back into the pelvic cavity. It goes over the top of the urinary bladder and then courses inferiorly at the posterior margin of the urinary bladder, and there it meets the seminal vesicle, right behind the urinary bladder, right here. So there's a seminal vesicle. And it forms about 60% of the semen volume. It produces sperm nutrients. So I'm just going to ask you to know one thing. Just say sperm nutrients. It produces a whole list of stuff, but for this class, we'll just say sperm nutrients, because they need energy, because they're what? They're swimming around all over the place. All right, the prostate gland. So here is a prostate gland right here. That's where the ejaculatory duct and the urethra join. That produces a neutralizing solution for, when I say neutralizing, it neutralizes acids. Because in the male urethra, it's a very acidic environment. And the female vagina is also very acidic. And that's kind of a good thing, because that inhibits bacteria from growing in the penis and the vagina. But not only does it inhibit bacteria, it inhibits sperm. So when sperm passes through that area, if it's very acidic, then sperm motility is going to be decreased. And then, of course, fertilization won't take place. So the prostate gland helps neutralize those environments so that sperm have the proper motility. All right, so there's the prostate gland. And then the last one, the bulbourethral gland, doesn't secrete much, only about 5% of the semen volume. And it secretes mucus, right, for lubrication. But another thing, too. So here's that bulbourethral gland, secretes a little bit of mucus. Mucus is a protein. It's proteinaceous in nature. And any kind of protein acts like a buffer as well. So it helps adjust the pH of the male urethra and the female vagina so that the motility of the sperm, right, is maintained. So that's the job of the bulbourethral gland. Okay, well, remember one time we talked about a disease process that pretty much just affects women as they grow older. And we said that it's really rare that there's a disease process that's going to affect everybody in the population. Okay, can anybody remember what that disease process was? And it's osteoporosis, right? So if every woman in here is lucky enough to live long enough, okay, they'll probably have to deal with osteoporosis. And why is that so rare that everybody in the population is going to suffer from that same disease process? As a matter of fact, there's only two diseases that I can think of that are like that. Of all the millions of diseases we can come down with, there's only two that I can think of. But why is it that it's so rare that every woman in here is going to, okay, face osteoporosis if you're lucky enough to live long enough? Why is that? Okay. And the answer is, it has to do with this chapter right here. The answer is because we reproduce by sexual reproduction. Okay, which does what? When organisms reproduce by sexual reproduction, that means that everybody's different. Right? Because there's diversity in the population, it is extremely rare that the whole population is going to be susceptible to that one disease process. right? And that's why you can't hardly find any diseases that everybody will succumb to, because we're a diverse population. And we're a diverse population, why? Why are we a diverse population? Because we reproduce through sexual means, right? Because some people have a penis, some people have vaginas. That's why we're a diverse population, okay? That's the reason why. All right, but the second disease process that I'm thinking of that all males will have to face, okay, as they get older, if they're lucky enough to live long enough, they're going to have to deal with, possibly, at one time. Oh, let me go back. For osteoporosis, how can you protect yourself from osteoporosis?
Calcium.
Okay, so you have to have calcium in your diet. So diet is number one. What else?
Exercise.
That's right, because when you exercise a muscle, it gets bigger and stronger. But when you exercise a bone, guess what? It gets bigger and stronger too, right? But especially premenopausally. Exercise for women premenopausally makes their bones get bigger and stronger and protects them from osteoporosis. Okay. Now let's go back to the male. So what is the disease process that all males will have to deal with if they are lucky enough to live long enough? Prostate disease. That's right, because this prostate right here, okay, likes to get bigger and bigger and bigger. It grows. We call that hypertrophy. And can you imagine what happens to the rest of your body when the prostate gland hypertrophies, when it gets bigger? Look what happens. What gets blocked? The urethra gets blocked as this prostate gland swells up as it gets bigger. So males have trouble voiding. And if that prostate gets real big, they probably can't void at all. Well, you know, it's really kind of a terrible situation. And of course, ejaculation, right, is going to be inhibited as well because the ejaculatory duct is occluded. Okay, so both urinary and sexual function diminish as somebody has prostatic disease. And there are two kinds of prostatic disease, probably many more than that, but two generally. There's one that's benign, and there's one where the prostate turns cancerous. All right, and then that's bad because then these prostate cells can break off and go to your brain and kill your brain or bone or liver or things like that. Okay, so there might be a time when you have to find out if you have benign prostatic hypertrophy. That means that the prostate is just big, or is it cancerous? If it's cancerous, it's probably best that it's removed. But if it's just benign, then a lot of times we can just insert a catheter with a balloon right up here in the urethra and blow the balloon up and squish open the urethra, and then maybe that opens up that passageway enough to where you can void. Okay, or maybe they even go in now and start to ablate some of this tissue, or maybe even put in a little radioactive capsule right there to kill the tissue, different ways. One of the surgeries, I don't know if anybody's doing, was actually to take some tubes, right, and stick it into the, from various angles, stick it into the prostate, and then flow liquid nitrogen, okay, which then would freeze the prostate gland. So that was actually kind of a better idea than actually going in there and trying to rip it open, because when you start doing surgery someplace, what is always one of the side effects of doing surgery? You have infection is one, that's always for sure the case. Okay, but let's just say, let's load them up with a lot of antibiotics and hopefully they have their spleen, right, and healthy otherwise, and they can maybe fight infection. But anytime you do surgery, you end up with scar tissue, right? So you can go in and remove a prostate, but there's almost no way to control how that scar tissue is going to reform, and you need scar tissue for that area to heal. And so instead of having a hypertrophied prostate, now you got a lot of scar tissue, and that might even be worse than the situation that you started with, right? It's always hard to tell what's going to happen there. All right, so the best thing to do is to protect your prostate gland. So how do you protect a prostate gland? How do you protect yourself from osteoporosis? Diet and, well, I would say diet and exercise, right? And of course, calcium, diet and exercise. And that's the same thing that you have to do for the prostate gland, is diet and exercise, same things. Okay, all cancers we know, well not all, but probably many, many cancers are promoted by high-fat diet, right? So if you're on a low-fat diet, that was probably protective of the prostate gland. And exercise, of course, I don't mean like lifting weights or anything. I mean exercise that specifically exercises the prostate gland. Right, so diet and exercise is always the preferred method for keeping your body healthy, including the prostate gland right here. Okay. So here is a picture of a sperm, and it doesn't look like a normal kind of human cell. All right, in this area right here, this was what makes up the head of a sperm cell. It's got a very small cell with almost no cytoplasm. It contains almost all chromosomes. Right, so in this area right here, it's just full of chromosomes. And then the acrosome, the tip of the sperm cell, has a bunch of digestive enzymes in it, so that when it bumps into an egg cell, it has a way to inject this nuclear material into the egg to join the nuclear material from the egg. All right, and then this is the flagellum. This is the mid-piece right here. This is the piece that contains mitochondria that makes ATP so that this flagellum can whip back and forth. Okay. All right, so that's what a sperm looks like. And the last thing that I want to show you is, I hope I have a picture of this spermatic cord. Maybe I don't. I don't have a picture of spermatic cord. So I'll have to show you this right here. Okay, so the vas deferens, you can see, moves from the scrotum back up into the pelvic cavity. There is a hole in the body wall of males, which we call the inguinal canal, that carries the vas deferens back into the pelvic cavity. And within that inguinal canal, there is what we call the spermatic cord. The spermatic cord has a number of components, not just the vas deferens. Right, but it also has to have a blood supply that goes to the testes. That's what we call the testicular artery. Blood has to return to the pelvic cavity. We call that the testicular vein. And then there are nerves. Those are the testicular nerves. And then there are muscles, too. Okay, and we call that the cremaster muscle. So what did I tell you to look at here? The spermatic cord is formed with the artery, the vein, the nerve, some connective tissue, and skeletal muscle. Okay, you don't have to know the names of these things. Okay, with the, of course, the vas deferens makes the spermatic cord. Right. You don't have that in your notes? Is that what you're trying to tell me? Okay. Okay, well, I want to draw some other stuff on the board before we go. So I'm going to have to erase the nephron right here. And I want to talk about spermatogenesis and oogenesis a little bit. And I'm going to start out by asking you, how is genetic information contained in our body? What are the structures that contain DNA? That they're in the nucleus. Yeah, they're in the nucleus, so they're safe. Right, they're contained in the nucleus so that genetic material doesn't get corrupted or destroyed. But how is DNA contained in our body? What structure? What kind of molecule does it make? What's the building block of DNA? Did we have to know that sometime? It's called nucleotides make up DNA. Okay, and if we have a big long molecule of DNA, your body stores it as a chromosome. It stores it as a chromosome. So how many chromosomes do humans have? And there's no way that you would really know this unless you took a biology class or something. Okay. We have 46 chromosomes altogether. And different animals will have a different number. All right, so we have 46. So most cells in your body have 46 chromosomes inside the nucleus. Okay, and so this is what we call just a somatic cell, just a normal cell, like cells that make up your skin and muscles and things like that. Okay, and if we go from this cell and it wants to divide, all right, and it produces these two cells by a process that you had to know about called mitosis, right here. How many chromosomes are in these cells right here when a cell reproduces just asexually by mitosis, like when your skin cells divide to build more skin cells? You know what? It's going to have the exact same number, 46. and 46. So remember, we call these the daughter cells, and this is the parent cell. And what's the difference between these two daughter cells?
None,
exactly the same. And these daughter cells are exactly like the parent cell. Okay. Well, this is not how sexual reproduction works. This is just an asexual process. There's another process that takes place. Okay, so this other process is when a cell divides and it produces a couple different cells now that have half the number of chromosomes in them, or 23. And the reason why you end up with half is because even though you have 46 chromosomes, you actually have specifically two sets of chromosomes. So let's make two sets right here. All right, you have a number 1, a number 2, a number 3, all the way down to number 23. And then over here, you got another number 1 and another number 2. 3, down to 23. So number 1s have the same size and shape. They contain similar kinds of information, but not identical information. One set you get from your mom. So we say, we give that's the M set, right? And where do you get the other set from? Your dad. But we'll say that's P. Okay, so what does P stand for? That is, you could say papa, but it's actually what? Paternal, right? These are your paternal chromosomes and these are your maternal chromosomes, paternal and maternal chromosomes. So you actually have two sets. So this process where you have a reduction of chromosomes, this is what we call meiosis. So going from 46 to 23 is meiosis. And these things over here are what we call gametes. So what's a name of a gamete? Sperm. And this could be an egg. So here is a sperm or an egg. Right? But not from the same. This would be if this process was happening in a woman. Right? Sperm if this was happening in a man. Okay, so these are both gametes, and that's going to go back to forming a cell that has 46 chromosomes. So what happens if you have a sperm and an egg unite? That's going to produce a single cell. How many chromosomes now are going to be in this single cell down here? 46 again. All right. So what's the name of this process? Taking two gametes and ending up with 46 chromosomes again. What's that process called? Yeah, everybody knows, but you haven't thought about it maybe quite this way. That's what we call fertilization. Okay? Fertilization. All right, then the other thing that I want to ask you is that this cell right here, and we all were just a single cell at one point in our life, this thing here has got a name. What is this single cell product of fertilization called? Okay, and that thing is indeed what we call a zygote. That's a zygote. Can you read when I write on the side? So that's a zygote. All right, so meiosis produces gametes. Gametes come together via fertilization, and that produces zygotes. Okay. All right, so that's a sexual reproduction process because genetic material from two different individuals come together to form a new and unique organism down here, that zygote. All right, so remind me to start, or I'll just write it down, start here. Next time, female reproductive system, but I tell you what, we got to take a quiz next time. You want to take it at the beginning of class or at the end of class next time? Okay, so urinary quiz at the beginning of class next time.